All right, so it's a great pleasure to have Professor Gutierrez from Harvard Medical School with us today. He's going to talk about a system he's been developing for several years now, and it's called 3D Slicer. And as you know, his expertise is primarily on brain-related interventional radiology as well applications, but he specializes a lot in software development that, you know, everybody can use and would be using too. I mean, some of you have been using, because right now it's linked to ITK anyway. So he's going to talk today about all these applications. And just for the record, I mean, he did his medical doctorate degree in Switzerland.
Yeah.
Very Swiss. I love the experience. And also he has a degree in technical, in computer science, right?
No. My only real degree is an MD.
Ah, okay.
When I was promoted to professor, they gave me an honorary degree.
But as well as there is also about medical degrees that don't mean anything. Some people have degrees, don't know anything. So he's equally competent in software. So, and therefore this combination is very good, as you know. And he's heading the surgical planning lab at Harvard. So, Brigham and Women's. So, we hope, of course, we'll be collaborating with him in the future a lot more. But today he's going to talk to us about his system. So, pay attention because it's a very nice system. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks. And I have to contradict you one more time. I'm equally incompetent in all the fields. And that's the fate of when you choose to work in interdisciplinary domains, is that by necessity you have your home field, and then you have the other field where you have to have enough knowledge to be able to collaborate, but often you don't end up having enough knowledge to do everything yourself. And that's exactly what I've specialized in the last quarter century, is to not have enough knowledge.
But you know how to collaborate, that's
yes.
Important.
So the joke is the best rabbit on the fish market. So before I'll start my presentation, I would like to start with acknowledgements. What I'll be telling you about is an effort that spans many years and many, many people and many institutions. And accordingly, and it's all research, and so there are lots of people involved, and there are lots of funding sources involved. It's the only way to get something like this going. And you'll see more acknowledgements on individual slides. So 3D Slicer is what I focused my own efforts for the last 5-6 years. I've done before work basically clinical training, then I've done some technical training, computer vision, and have worked on different algorithms in collaboration with computer scientists. I don't speak math and I don't write code, but I can speak with mathematicians and I can speak with software engineers. And over the years, I migrated. So first I did some algorithms and published papers and so on. And then I got frustrated with the fact we had all these beautiful papers. And none of these papers had really an impact on the practice of medicine. So how do we get those, thank you. How do we get those beautiful algorithms into something that is actually usable, initially for clinical research and ultimately in medical applications? And that's basically what an attempt at answering that problem is, what Slicer really is. So, basically, so there is algorithm science. Then you take an algorithm, which typically is implemented in MATLAB these days, and only runs on the grad student's computer and nowhere else, and turn it into a tool. And then finally use the tool to do biomedical research. So it's kind of a, the first question is, can it be done? That's where traditionally the medical image computing community stops, when the answer is, it can be done. But then in order to answer the question, is it worth doing, which is a different question, the biomedical research angle of it, you have to get tools into the hands of clinicians who are willing to do research. And it turns out that that step is actually a very challenging step, because it is a step for which the current research environment is not really suited. Funding agencies want to fund innovative research. They don't want to fund engineering. Companies want to develop products based on proven technology. And between those two areas, there is a gap. And from the point of view of making research happen, I've started thinking of this as a valley of death, because that's where everything stops. And what we are trying to do is build, in our domain at least, a bridge across this valley. Now, a lot of the work that I've been doing is really in subject-specific analysis. And that's a little bit different from what traditional research in our domain, image-based analysis, is done, where a lot of the technology has been developed in the last two decades by the neuroscience community. The neuroscience community has really pushed group comparisons. So if you optimize solutions for group comparisons, you have a different constraint space for your solutions. You can live with algorithms that are a little bit noisy, in the sense that they have some false positives and false negatives, because you'll make up by summing up results from a lot of individuals. You can't do this when you have to do subject-specific analysis, so you have to optimize and design your algorithms for a different sweet spot. So this group comparison style of research, it's basically things like the question, where is a normal function typically located, and what's the normal variability, functional structure. Let's say, look around the room, the variability of noses. So where is the nose in the face? Sounds like a trivial question, but if you start thinking, where is the boundary between the nose and the cheek, it starts getting tricky. So, where's the nose in the face, and what's the variability of noses in a normal healthy population? As opposed to translational clinical work, which is subject-specific analysis, which often has to deal with pathology, so not just normal subjects, but patients, and patients have pathology that deviates from normalcy. And you need to know not just about the pathology, but often about surrounding structures. So the example you see here is brain tumor. So you need to know where's the brain tumor, because that's what you want to remove as a surgeon. But you also need to know where are arteries in the vicinity of the tumor, because that's certainly something you don't want to cut into. And also structures that are critical structures. So, again, it's a very different set of questions, and accordingly, the technological answers must be different, and that turns out to be a problem. Now, there's also an operational aspect. Again, it doesn't sound like science, but it really is a very different thing, which is when you do these basic science prospective studies, you take months to years to set up the study, then you take months to years to acquire the actual data, then you can take months or years to do the analysis of the data. And so it's a very different mindset when you do this, as opposed to if you want to do really translational research in a clinical research environment, then you have to comply with the needs of a clinical environment, which means the patient has a scan today, and if it's a surgery, the surgery might happen tomorrow. And if you have image-guided therapy, where you have the imaging devices in the operating room, then the scan is done and the surgery continues. So you have at most a few minutes to do whatever you do. Also, basic scientists are a very hardy crowd. They are willing to put up with a lot of pain. And so if the software is not user-friendly, who cares? It's basically, time doesn't count. The time of the scientist in basic science doesn't count. If you are in a clinical environment, it's very different. Time that somebody has to invest to learn to use the system is important, and the time it takes to do a single analysis is important too. It, they turn it from something that's negligible in basic science to something that is a critical pass requirement if you go into this translational clinical environment. Now, there is another aspect that has emerging. Increasingly, there is in a sub-community of the medical image computing community a new style of research using open source, open data, and an open community approach. Now, this is not something that works for everything, and it's not something that works for everybody. So I'm not saying this is the new way and everybody should abandon what they've been doing and so on. But there is a lot of advantage to this approach. So this is not communism. This is something where there is self-interest. For instance, you have a new algorithm. How do you know that your new algorithm really represents an improvement compared to the current state of the art? Today, in a thesis, typically you read the paper, re-implement the algorithm, and compare it. Now, that means that you might or might not be familiar with the ins and outs of the algorithm. Optimizing algorithms, optimizing parameters is a very tricky business. And often when somebody who is not the initial author tries to do it, they end up with suboptimal settings. So that means that the comparisons are not really apples to apples, but apples to oranges. An open science approach, part of what is emerging, and for instance in the Mikai community, is these competitions where there are sample data sets, particular solutions that are being looked for, and then everybody works with the same data under the same conditions, and that's when you can really compare whether the how the algorithms work relative to each other. In clinical, there is another aspect, another issue that also we need to consider. Once we work with patients, we have to consider privacy of the patient, and that's on one thing, it's just something that we should do anyway. But on top of it, there are federal laws and regulations in the US about protection of patient privacy. And the penalties can be fairly stiff. So for instance, you take a single image out of a CAT scan of a subject. They are typically stored in a format that is called DICOM. The DICOM header contains patient information like first name, last name, date of birth, and a number of other fairly generic pieces of information. The appropriate law about HIPAA basically says every time you violate the privacy of a patient by making this information available outside of what is appropriate, for each field there is a fine of $600. So there are 16 such identifiers in a single DICOM header. You have a CT data set from here to here. These days it can be between 500 and even 1,000 slices. So 1,000 times 16 times 600, that's a single scan. So it can get expensive very quickly. And so the institutions who are liable, primary liabilities are with the hospitals, they have become very defensive. So easiest it is easiest for scientists to exchange anonymized data if possible, because then you can just get rid of this information. Sometimes that's not an option. But in general, the hospitals prefer not to give the data to people outside their own environment. And so, for instance, cloud computing, just to give you an example, is not really something that the hospitals would like to have, unless it's a private cloud. And so having a piece of software that will run on a local infrastructure, not on a cluster computer, but on a local infrastructure, makes life much easier when you're in clinical research. And I mean, all of these things, this is not science, but it does have a huge impact on how science is done. And if you have the right setup, you can actually get rid of some of those hurdles without having to do extra work. If you take it, so anonymizing data wherever possible takes away 80% of the headaches of this kind, if you can do it. So, Slicer, again, it's a platform. It's a platform. It provides you with some generic or commodity-style infrastructure, 3D reconstructions, so triangulated surface models, volume rendering. You can combine different volumes. We have a number of algorithms interfaced to Slicer, such as registration, segmentation algorithms, and there is a plugin architecture. So if you have your own algorithm, you can plug it into Slicer, and that means that you don't need to take care of the display, you don't need to take care of reading DICOM files, and all of these things are done for you. You get it for free as a package. In return, you have to learn how to interface with this package. So that's kind of the trade-off. With funding from NIH, we have basically developed an entire software engineering methodology to do this. So Slicer Core is written in C++ and uses VTK for visualization, and uses ITK and Python for different types of processing. There is a number of other packages included that are being used for infrastructure work, CTK, GDCM for the DICOM. In the close future, we will switch to DCMTK for DICOM. And everything is basically packaged in such a way that you can download Slicer. When you download Slicer, it downloads with all the necessary libraries and toolkits. And all the passes are set in such a way that basically it's a self-contained directory. So you can have two different versions of Slicer running in parallel to each other on the same machine at the same time. And again, no big science there, but a lot of very hard engineering. And if you use Slicer, somebody else has done most of it for you. You still need, if you do a plugin, make sure that your plugin will take advantage of this. So it's not depends on how complicated things get, but that's essentially the value proposition. And Slicer is open source. You can just go to slicer.org. There are directions how to download this, how to check out the source code. There is also pre-computed executables that are available for download for Windows, Mac, and Linux. And that's another thing is that we actually try to be multi-platform, which again, the advantage is that basically it really doesn't matter what the individual users use. You prefer Mac, you can have a Mac. You prefer Windows, you can have it on Windows. But on the software engineering side, it's actually not trivial to make things work across the platforms. But most of it was done by other people, so you don't have to do it. the community that develops and works in this environment is a very widespread community, different funding agencies, of course in the US primarily NIH, but we have some international participants that have government funding from their own governments. And as you see, there are projects that affect different disease groups all over the body. And this slide, we try to kind of demonstrate this, that there is a different organ regions and disease concepts, different geographies, different funding sources, and it all comes together. Joining the community is basically you just participate. We have twice a year, we have so-called project events, and I think some of your people have gone to one of them, yes? So you're already familiar with it to some extent. One of the bigger funding sources is a National Center for Biomedical Computing grant from NIH. It is called NAMIC, National Alliance for Medical Image Computing. And in NAMIC, we have what NIH calls driving biological projects. And those are basically intended to explore the technology that we have and develop topic-specific solutions for particular projects and problems. And the current set of NAMIC DBPs includes a project about atrial fibrillation, about Huntington's disease, head and neck cancer, and traumatic brain injury. And as you see here, basically we do a little bit of monitoring on the website, and this is just downloads of the executables. So this is not the checkouts from source code. And we see about 20,000 downloads per year, which is not huge if you look at something like Mozilla, Firefox, but for a relatively specialized research package, that's actually quite a lot. So I'm very happy with that. So just to show you some examples, segmentation, we have fairly extensive implementation of the EM segmenter. I think you had Kilian Paul here last week, and some of his technology, his version is available in Slicer, but also the alternate implementation that is was done in ITK, the ITK EMS implementation. Same algorithmic engine, just two different implementations. We have a number of different registration algorithms. Again, we rely heavily on the ITK registration framework. And there are user interfaces that let non-computer scientists take advantage of those, including rigid, affine, and B-spline, and demons algorithm. In the last year, we've shifted mostly to a pipeline that was developed by Hans Johnson out of Iowa, who basically implemented a pipeline that was styled a little bit like the AIR package, but based entirely on ITK infrastructure. And that's essentially, right now, the best integrated package inside the Slicer environment. Slicer has a lot of visualization capabilities, triangulated surface models. We can also, under specialized conditions, load scalar fields so that we can do parametric maps on the triangulated surface models. We can combine the surface models with cross sections, and those cross sections can be oriented arbitrarily. We have volume rendering available. Volume rendering is quite tricky. By the way, can we perhaps turn off the light? There's a little bit of glare. So So this here is a volume rendering from CT. Now, volume rendering, to do it in a multi-platform environment turns out to be very challenging because each environment has a slightly different capabilities and requirements. You can also reconfigure the appearance of slicers, so we can have something where you just see one big 3D window, or you see multiple windows with slice viewers and then a 3D window. So we have a lot of flexibility to do this, and there are a number of pre-configured layouts that are available. So I talked briefly about this algorithm comparison, and I think our community, the medical image computing community, is not doing enough of this. Mikhail, we have had now for several years efforts to do this. So there was an MS lesion effort, a liver segmentation effort, there was one for the cardiac coronary arteries. Again, in each of those cases, a number of standardized data sets were made available by the organizers. And then basically the result and objectives were defined, and then the results compared. So we decided to do something like this at this year's MIKAI about diffusion tensor imaging in the brain. DTI has been used for now almost a decade, and there are a lot of groups that work on this technology. But to the best of our knowledge, nobody had tried to do such a competition because it's kind of difficult. How do you define the tractography? So what we decided to do is to take data sets like what you see here. This is a 3-Tesla acquisition and the world DTI, a DWI acquisition. And to define an objective, which was to find the corticospinal tract, which is a very well-defined tract in the brain. So there were four patients and there were two healthy subjects. And the healthy subject, one of them had traveled as far as a human phantom to a number of sites that were going to participate in a multi-center study. Where all the sites had the same MR scanner model from the same vendor, and they had the same acquisitions implemented. And so we felt it was a very good way to compare the reproducibility of those algorithms. And so some of this was done before the workshop, and some of the, and then we had an actual challenge where we gave them, the participants, two data sets at the workshop, and they had like 3 hours to actually perform the analysis on the fly. And it turned out quite interesting. So we had 8 teams participating, and basically, you see here like a little picture of the workshop room with the processing going on. And of course, one of the problems with tractography is that there is not really a ground truth, because what we actually extract or streamlines in a certain way are mathematical constructs that are supposed to reflect the fibers. But we have to remember that the DWI, the diffusion weighted images, are acquired somewhere between 1 millimeter to 2 millimeter cubed, while the actual nerve fibers
are microns.
The nerve fibers are a few microns across.
So when there was a study in the heart, they took out the heart,
yeah,
and they used it with the eye. It was in the workshop part, it was in the eye. And then they had the ground truth.
Mm-hmm.
So the DTI has no correlation with the fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was terrible, basically.
No correlation. Actually,
I mean, one correlation with, because they are so small, the fibers, and they change too fast orientation.
Yes,
and because of the cellulose.
That's exactly the problem. So the streamlines that we are extracting are really based on the result of a combination of a physical measurement process and a deterministic mathematical model. And accordingly, they do reflect reality with the limitations of this very complicated pipeline that results in the streamline. And you have to be aware of those limitations if you want to interpret the results properly. So I agree with you. So you have to be careful. You need to understand what's going on, otherwise
it's more like bundle tracking.
Yeah.
With whatever you can.
But so you were upset when I was explaining some of this. So what we did here, we told the participants to find the cortical spinal tract. The cortical spinal tract is a fairly large fiber bundle in the brain, and it has a distinct beginning, which is the pre-central gyrosomotor cortex, and it has a distinct end, which is the spinal cord. So you know exactly where it begins and where it ends. So I thought, it turns out that I was too optimistic or not careful enough, however you take it.
I was only talking about the heart, because I don't want
to. No, but it's the same thing. So, these are now the eight teams' performances in the same data set. So what we did, they ran their analysis, we gave them the data, they ran their analysis, then Sonia Pujol and my team converted the results of the analysis back into a format that's compatible with ours, so that we could really compare everybody with the same surroundings. And as you see, if you compare these fiber tracts with these or these, it's very clear that there is no agreement among those groups what constitutes the cortical spinal tract. In addition,
the DDI you did wasn't the 64, the Harvey, then the new protocol was the older.
So the majority of the data was older, because you know that's always like this. Two of them, however, have 90 orientations. They can actually be done. It turns out that that was not the problem. It turns out the problem was somewhere else entirely. There are actually two problems.
So who was closer? Was anybody closer?
So these guys were very robust, but they had a lot of false negatives. Because they're just a pencil going
like,
up,
like,
but that's
like,
not how the cortex
is. It's like filtering, too much filtering,
yeah.
Is robust.
Yeah, so they were too conservative. And then, of course, these guys had almost the whole brain cryptography, so they had too many false positives. And, of course, if you have a surgical objective, either of the two is not good.
So right now, how do they do it? They just guess? What would they do? Yes, I assume that.
And so I made sure that we had actually neurosurgery there, because these were neurosurgical cases. And so Ariana Barbi, who trained for 3 years at the SPL like 15 years ago and is now practicing neurosurgery in Germany, came to this event. And at one point, when just going back here, he asked the participants, imagine this is your brain. Which of those fiber bundles do you want me to base my surgical decision on if it's you? And there was, of course, just a nervous laugh. But I mean, that's of course. So potentially, these tractography results contain clinically very important information. The cortical spinal tract connects the brain the body.
Yeah.
You cut in a particular location, patient wakes up with a palsy and cannot use the right hand anymore. So this is not child's play. And if they don't have it, they still have to do the surgery, because if they don't do the surgery, the patient's dying, that's not good.
Yeah.
And so it's one of these damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah.
And the surgeons are desperate to find more information, but the technology has been developed for neuroscience use, not for surgical use. So that's what was my kind of motivation to drive this particular one, to give people in the field, like an idea, you could try to target something else, not just neuroscience. But here it gets even worse. What you see here is from this normal subject. So I mentioned before, one subject traveled around, had 10 different scans. It was a healthy subject. All scans were done with the same acquisition sequence on the same type of scanner, on the same vendor. So you would expect the data to reflect the same thing. So this is team one across the 10 scans, team two, and so on. I randomly picked one of them, and so this is one team on one subject where there is, to the best of our knowledge, no pathology, no changes.
What is the colors, the blue, the green?
A fractional anisotropy. But even if you disregard the colors, if you see this variability, this is crazy. It should be exactly the same every time, and it's not. Now, so we had during the workshop a discussion about this because it was surprising to everyone.
So it's at the same person at different scans, and these are the results of the same person.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, what it turns out is that, so we had told them find the corticospinal tract, but did not say anything more. So where is the corticospinal tract? As I said, it goes from the motor cortex, which is the precentral gyrus, to the spinal cord. So if you do tractography like this, what you do is you do seeding. So where do you do the seeding? So the precentral gyrus is very difficult to find on the, not very difficult, but more difficult to find on the slices than the spinal cord. You know, spinal cord, you just go far enough down and you'll find it. So everybody was seeding their tractography from the spinal cord. Problem is that the spinal cord contains the corticospinal tract, but also contains fibers that go into the thalamus and fibers that go into the corona radiata and into other places. And all those fibers are on a micron scale, and we do millimeter scale, so 3 orders of magnitude coarser sampling. So of course, each of those voxels is basically the tensor average of all the pieces of axons inside. And so you get a lot of basically randomization artifacts, even a little bit of shift. And I think that's my interpretation of the scene. So what they should have done, and nobody realized it, and I wasn't out to get them. If I had realized it, I would have told them to do it this way. But what they should have done is seed in the precentral gyrus, and then do a termination in the spinal cord, as opposed to the other way around. So basically what our plan is now, to have everybody here under analysis with this knowledge that we didn't have before, and that's what we'll be hopefully can actually do.
Can I ask you what we're seeing here? So I see a slice, this is a slice like this now?
Yeah, so what you have here is an axial slice, you have here is a coronal slice, so you see those two slices.
That's why I see the spinal cord down there, right?
And we are just showing the we extract from the DTI data set the scalar volume that shows fractional anisotropy. So white is high fractional anisotropy and dark is low fractional anisotropy. And we just provided this as a backdrop so that it's not just out in space.
But this is down is the spinal cord.
Yes,
right?
Yes. It's actually, if you see here, you see a little bit, it's like a butterfly.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So it's more on the level of midbrain.
Yeah. The funny thing is it starts there and goes, but as you see, it doesn't only go to the motor core, it goes to many other things.
Yes.
So they didn't know basically anatomy of the brain?
They didn't know enough of anatomy, but that's exactly, I did not expect it, otherwise I would have wondered. They did not know enough of these things to do it right. But at least three of the teams had consulted with neuroradiologists whether the results were correct. So they were even more disappointed because they actually went all the way out to ask for help and advice. But they got advice, but not the right one. That's exactly because the neuroradiologists in turn are not familiar with this technology. So they just saw fibers and they were happy. So in hindsight, it's really a very classical demonstration of what can go wrong in interdisciplinary work. They were talking, but they were not communicating successfully.
You say, and I fully agree with this, like you work on something, you have to understand what you're working on. Don't just develop an algorithm without understanding the analogy. Like working on the heart, but you don't know how heart looks. Then.
Yes. So that's exactly part of the message. If you work in the interdisciplinary domain, you must take the effort to learn enough of that other domain that you understand the concepts and you know what questions to ask.
This is a classic.
And as I say, I wasn't out to get them. If I had known this, I would have even before.
No, I know that, but I thought they would know the anatomy without you. You just told them the right thing. You didn't expect they don't do truly multidisciplinary research, so they don't guess.
I thought so too, but it turns out that that's not the case. It turns out that some of the groups actually consulted with a specialist, but did not get the proper advice. That's why I'm telling this story. It's really a warning story.
Yeah, it's very good. That's why I want to emphasize that to my students too. It's not math for math, it's math for medicine.
Now, so this is about comparing apples and apples. Now, there is another aspect, and that's one I also, it's again poking a little bit. So most of science is done in a quantitative way. It's one of the foundations of science is the quantification and reproducibility. So when you do image analysis, you want to do quantitative analysis. And in Slicer, there are some examples and some infrastructure for this. Now, it turns out that in clinical medicine, quantitative science in imaging is a very exotic world. Radiologists look at images, they don't measure images. And the clinicians don't measure images because they don't often even know how to access the images. And so one example is evaluating tumor size. The clinical standard was developed, again, for clinical cancer studies. It's a very coarse measure called RECIST. And it is designed to detect changes of about 20%. If you have change that's less than 20%, RECIST is not going to detect it reliably. But it is simple and any idiot can learn how to do it. So it has the advantage of simplicity and robustness and the disadvantages of lack of sensitivity. So what do you do if you have tumors that change by less than that? Today, there's not a lot. Radiologists look at the images and then they basically review the images. And here you see an example. So this is a meningioma on a T1 weighted MRI scan. The meningioma after application of gadolinium BTPA. The meningioma basically shows up very bright. There are some bright things. This is the subcutaneous fat. This is a large vein in the skull, the superior sagittal sinus. The line that you see here is the falx, which is a stiff membrane between the two halves of the brain. the meningioma actually originates from the pharynx.
So the pharynx is affected now, or just that location now?
Pharynx is part of the meninges, and the meningioma is a benign tumor of the meninges. So, this is the scan that was done in 2006. In this particular case, this was an older patient, and the meningiomas grow very, very, very slowly. So often, the decision is not to do anything, just to observe, and as long as there are no symptoms, you'll just leave it alone. Now, from patient's point of view, it's of course a different story. It looks very scary. There is something in my head, and it's growing. So the patients, when they have these scans every year, they get very anxious. So this patient came back in 2007, had the follow-up scan, so you see the two scans. So has the tumor grown or not? Now, if you read this, so the first is the report from radiologist one in 2006. In 2007, the scan was read by a different radiologist, because that's very often the case in a clinical environment, that the follow-up scan is not read by the same person. So here you have 3.1 centimeter by 3.05 by 3.5, and here you have 3.3 by 3.2. But the second radiologist says it's unchanged. Patient says, so what's going on here? You give me completely different numbers. I don't know what it means. And so the neurosurgeon came to us and asked, can you give us something to help with this? So we developed a module. And again, there is no fancy science here. This is basically a four-step analysis. You identify the data. You identify volume of interest, you identify the structure of interest inside the volume, and then you do a change analysis. Now, for change analysis, you don't necessarily even need to do segmentation, because you're only interested in change. Then, even let's say here, we have the pharynx, it's bright, it's not tumor, but we don't expect the pharynx to change. Tumor is bright, and we if there is change, we expect to see something. Here you see the results. And so most of the changes in this case were in a subvoxel level. And so when you consider registration and all the other issues that come into play, basically the meaning is that it probably didn't change. But on the other hand, because we can do it really on a super sample data set at subvoxel resolution, even if those are minute changes that might be artifactual, we can still look at the entirety and see if there's a trend. And what we see here, this is where we had increase growth, and this is where we had some decrease of the signal. Most of this is in the pharynx, but this and this might represent a small amount of growth. But as you see here, we are talking like less than one cubic centimeter. So it's really very, very little.
And no symptoms? The patient has no symptoms.
This module was mostly intended for psychotherapy, to show the patient's quantitative number that was consistent.
I'm so surprised, 3 centimeters is pretty big. 3 centimeters is pretty big.
Yeah, but they go very slowly. Yeah. So the brain has time to adjust.
Ah, that's why. Because I was thinking 3 centimeters pushes a lot. Right?
These things go over 10 years. And so the brain gets deformed around.
But if they are deadly, in the end, or if they go too much?
You know, if you're 80 years old and you have something that will go for 15 years before it reaches death, it could potentially be deadly, but there's a fair chance that something else will kill you before. Yes. And in this case, in such a scenario, why torture the patient with surgery? Every surgery
they can radiate. They cannot radiate.
These are highly they are not. Really, surgery is the treatment for this, as opposed to glioblastomas. That's a different story. And they're usually not too difficult to remove. It depends on the location. But on the other hand, if it's an unnecessary surgery, then why do it? Okay, so this was an example of quantitative imaging. But there is another domain where we need a lot of image processing, but it's not quantitative. For instance, when we do surgical planning, for certain things you need to be very precise, but for other things you don't need to be very precise. And so this is, and why do I mention this? Is because sometimes precision costs you time. And if you have all the time in the world, then you can be very precise. But if you have only 2 minutes to do the post-processing for your case, then sometimes you might be willing to trade off some of this precision. So for this type of interactive tools, over the years I've kind of extracted these rules that I'm telling the grad students these days. And I put them actually on the website, on the Slicer website. So if you are looking for Ron's rules for tools, you'll find it if you Google that expression. And so the first one, you make it, I break it. What I mean by that is you have to really work on robust tools as opposed to algorithms that can be very finicky. There's a big difference between a finicky algorithm with 20 parameters, the robust tool, because you, when you develop an algorithm, you usually have your database of 5 or 10 or 20 cases, and that's what you work with. And for sure, when I try out your algorithm, I use a different case, then it breaks every time. The next one, it's done. It's done when it runs on my machine with my data. Until then, it's not done. And I've had many projects that basically failed to reach that level. It sounds, again, the way it's formulated, it's tongue-in-cheek, but it is actually a very, very challenging requirement. Get it to a point where I can use it, because I'm not you, so I'm pretty stupid, and I make all the mistakes that you can make, I can guarantee you. So, we have an environment in Slicer specifically designed for this type of things, which is the interactive editor. So again, when you have algorithms that run essentially automatically, but where you're willing to take input and guidance from the user, it turns out it defines a very different set of technologies, because many of the difficult things, which is kind of to figure out where is the liver inside the data set? You don't need to know. I'll tell you. I'll put a marker or a swipe or something inside that structure. But then the things that I'm not good at is giving the volume of the liver. That's something that people are not very good at by looking at the images. That's something that algorithms normally are pretty good. And so there is this entire interactive processing framework that is built into Slicer, and we are in the process right now for the next generation of Slicer is to allow to have plugins in the inside that module. And so basically ITK or whatever you prefer, then with a Python wrapper into this editor module. And so what you see here is an example of such a segmentation. What you see here I can do on a full-size MR data set in about 3 minutes. and not just in the slides, but as you see in the volume, from the raw data. And then you combine this with cryptography, and here you see peritumoral white matter tract. So again, nothing quantitative here, but we are using, of course, algorithms and tools that are based on quantitative criteria, but the end result is the visualization. So even if we go to the tumor boundary off by one or two voxels, it's no big deal, because during the surgery, they'll have to check anyway. So here, by the way, is now a second example. So before, when we were talking about DTI, I mentioned this is the central sulcus and this is the precentral gyrus motor cortex. Now this is a different example. You have here a tumor, so this is a T1 weighted image without contrast. You see that here this area is a little bit darker. There are other areas that are dark, but this is normal gray matter, deep gray matter. This is not normal if you compare the two sides. This is actually a brain tumor. Now in this case, the brain tumor is somewhere in this area. So one of the functions in this area is speech. So there is a location in the superior temporal gyrus, which is called Wernicke's area. There's a second one, more in the frontobasal lobe, which is called Broca's area. And both of those areas have roles in the control and creation of speech. And the two are connected by a white matter fiber tract. It's called the alveolar fasciculus.
Ron, I can you tell us about the physiology? Why a lot of the functionality so much on the surface? The gyra was also in.
So,
why not inside?
Some of it is inside. Yeah. So, again, the brain in general, we have the white matter, and the white matter is mostly connectivity. Then we have the gray matter, this narrow ribbon that you see here, and that's where all the processing happens. Now, processing means that there are local connections as well. So in the gray matter, you also have fibers connecting on a short distance. But then you have the long distance ones, which connect this to this, which would be the frontal occipital tract. Or here in this example, this to this, which is the arcuate.
So always the circuitry is via the white matter.
The long distance. So, to give you an analogy, a map. So these tracts, corticospinal tract, the arcuate fasciculus, and there's a number of others, are the equivalent to the interstate highways. Those are the long distance connections. And then you have basically local, inside an area, a lot of connectivity, and then from one area to the next one. So the connectivity from here to here, the fibers go like this. They are called U fibers because they have a U shape. And then you have these long distance connections. Now, why is it on the surface? Because that's where the neocortex is. So a lot of the higher level functions like speaking and kind of abstract thinking are relatively new in terms of the developmental history of the human race. And because of this, they are on the neocortex, and the neocortex is mostly on the outside. Yeah. Some of the older functionalities, this deep gray matter, this is older functionality that you'll find also in more primitive animals. And there it's organized in a different way.
There's also something like a ring, that they have the old brain with a new brain.
Yeah.
Where is that?
Sorry?
Is it like a ring where this connectivity, like the old brain connects to a new brain through, I was told by someone, I don't remember the name, like connectivity wise, as the fiber go from the spine, then you have the old brain, you know, moving and stuff, and then there's the new brain, but this separation between the through some brain.
No, there's not a separation, but what it is, the connections from the spine and cerebellum to the neocortex runs through these structures here.
Ah, yes. How does it hold it?
The internal capsule. And it has an anterior limb and a posterior limb. And here is gray matter. This is the putamen. And this is gray matter. This is the carpet nucleus. And back here you have the thalamus. And here in between you have this internal capsula. And what I mentioned before, the corticospinal tract is in the posterior component, but towards the front of the internal capsule. But in, just going back to this case, what we have here, so now the tumor, the question is, where is the tumor relative to Wernicke's area? If you look at the cross sections, it's kind of difficult to say. So we would like to have a quick and dirty 3D of the brain surface, just to have a quick look at the pattern of the gyri, okay? So we have in Slicer basically a module that is a skull stripper that is very rough. It shaves off part of the brain. It leaves in something. So it's really rough and tumble, not very precise. It's not good enough to do neuroscience, but you need to be very careful. But if you just want to know where is the superior temporal gyrus relative to the tumor, you strip the skull, and then you do volume rendering. And so I can get, essentially, from this view to this view in about 2 minutes. And here, if you know new anatomy, this is the superior temporal gyrus. So the tumor is below. So here is where we would expect Wernicke. That means that the arcuate fasciculus, which would go here, was pushed aside. And here, by the way, is the central sulcus. This is the precentral gyrus.
Yes, it looks more like rotated compared to the picture you have there.
Yes, and mirror. Because in this picture here, this is front, this is back, this is low. This is the temporal lobe, and this is the superior temporal gyrus. This picture here, this is the back, this is the front, this is the temporal lobe, superior temporal gyrus, and this is the tumor.
Yes.
Now, I just noticed it's now 12:30.
We did that one, we already got continue after.
I can go on. I just don't know how.
How much do you know?
The question is when is the hunger overcome?
I have to start worrying about us eating him.
Yeah. So maybe half or at maximum. So we'll go before 1 to 2 months.
Okay. So I'll do a few more minutes.
Yeah. Whatever you feel.
Yeah.
We always continue. We have time. I mean, we'll talk more.
Yeah. So, one aspect that I want to talk a little bit more. So, we talked about Slicer's software platform, modular, open source, this plugin architecture. You can do registration, you can do segmentation, you can do visualization. I've given you a few examples of some of the results. We also use Slicer as a platform for image-guided therapy. Image-guided therapy is where you use imaging to help in the execution of procedures. And you can go all the way to having imaging devices in the procedure room, in the operating room or in the interventional room. Now, there things, the game changes. Because until now, everything was software, it's in the clouds, and you ship things around and everything, as long as you have somewhere a computer to run, you can do it. When you begin to do procedures, you begin to get very close to hardware. You have to have an imaging device, you have a patient on the table, you have to have tracking devices, increasingly robotics and so on. And devices, by their very nature, are proprietary. This is a device. Somebody owns this device. It's not like software. I can just spread it out. The costs for spreading out once you have access to a web server are completely negligible. So devices are inherently something different. So then they are proprietary, and often the software is proprietary too. So you're basically facing the situation where you have this open source, open science environment. Then you have here an MR scanner or a tracking system or a surgical navigation system, which are inherently proprietary and closed. So what do you do? The solution we've come up with is to have an API. And in a certain way like this, this is a proprietary device, this is a proprietary device. They don't know about each other, and they don't need to know about each other because there is here an interface, an API. This one happens to be called USB, and it's a combination of some wires and some electrical specs, but it's also a software API, how the devices interact with each other. And because of this, whoever produces this doesn't need to know anything about what will be on the other side and vice versa, as long as both comply with the API. And so that's the basic notion that we decided to adopt for Slicer and how to interface Slicer with devices. Now, the work in Slicer is based on a large ongoing image-guided therapy program at the Brigham. 94, we opened the first interventional MRI system at the Brigham. This was a General Electric designed half Tesla system with a gap, so that the surgery could happen while the patient was in the imaging volume. So it was really easy to do integrated imaging and display. And as you see, with a display. So here's the display, here's the patient, here's an optical tracking system that tracks the needle, and the patient is looking, the surgeon is looking at images that are being...
They are not for brain, they are for general MR.
So in that environment, we did over 1,000 brain procedures, over 500 prostate procedure, MR-guided prostate brachytherapy seat positioning. And we did a number of other procedures, probably another 300 or 400 additional procedures. Close to 2,000 procedures overall. And most of them real surgeries, not just stick and needle. Then the magnet quench. At that point, we had already started to talk about the next generation environment. The problem was that the vendor, GE, was not really into image-guided therapy. So they didn't really integrate the environment, but they provided the scanner and everything else we were to do. And they didn't upgrade the software. So the machine basically fell behind the times. So it was not a workable environment. So we had started talking about the next generation environment, which is called AMIGO, Advanced Multimodality Image Guided Operating Suite. And that's basically my boss, Frank Gilles, has spent the way that I, in my little scale, have done the Slicer. He spent the last 10 years basically making AMIGO happen.
Yeah, so that's very impressive.
It's
the only one that exists. I don't see anything else.
So it's basically three rooms. There's a main operating room. There is a MR room that can be used as an interventional MRI room standalone, or the magnets of this door here is ceiling mounted and can come into the room and basically drive over the patient. So the patient doesn't move the magnet. Now, MR scanners are sensitive to motion, but by today's technologies, moving 2 tons is not a big deal. I mean, some of the macro engineering things, they're moving 100,000 tons at a precision of a few millimeters. So moving 2 tons is really nothing. And that's basically, there was a company that took a Siemens magnet and did develop the entire infrastructure to do this. And that company is called IMRIS. And the project started out as a Canadian project. A neurosurgeon in Calgary, Garnett Sutherland, started this, and then it was taken over by a Canadian business person and turned it into a company which is called Ingris. And they are right now selling these things for neurosurgery very successfully. They have now backlog of about 6 months, so they can't keep up this production.
You mean just the movement of the MR?
Yeah. So what they typically sell is to surgeons a 2-room suite, operating room and an MR shed. But what we are doing is use the same concept but expand it to whole body. So not just MR, not just the brain but whole body. But we have, in addition to the MR scanner, we have a floor system, a C-arm, that is capable of doing a rotational CT. CT, and there is a PET CT device. So that's what you see here. This is the ceiling mounted MR scanner. It's the main room, and over there is from the main room a look into the room with
the middle one. You said is fluoro, right? So it's not so accurate CT, but it's fast CT, right?
Yeah. So this is, it's again, it's a Siemens with a digital brain. And so the way it works is, here is the MR scanner. MR scanner comes on this track into the room patient here. This is the focal point of the MR scanner when it comes in. You want to do fluoro, you turn this table 90 degrees. So you see the color here, the green color. So the table gets turned, and that gives you this configuration. So here you see it again. The floor system is here. This is the floor. This is the MR system, and it moves here. And so basically the official opening was in May, and we have started doing procedures about a month ago. Now roughly 20 procedures, so early stages. But we have a list of candidate procedures that we want to begin working on. So,
of course, you get data you can use, right?
Hmm?
You get data from this.
And this is a top of the line Siemens whiteboard C-Tesla system. So I mentioned before this DTI data sets, the 90 direction, they were obtained on this system, on a patient before the surgery. Which, again, that's why we need to have fast post-processing, because the patient is on the table. After the scan, we need to start. Good. And I think probably here is as good a place as any to stop. If you want, I can show you a little bit of slides alive.
You want now or you want afterwards?
Oh, that's the top.
It really depends on you, so you eat.
Yeah.
So we can continue afterwards. So 3 o'clock is the difference. 3:30, yes. Let's say 3, so we're at.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. If you have any questions for us. But anyway, we'll show all of them. We'll have to talk. Okay, thank you very much.
Very nice. Yes, sir.